My name is David Wee. I'm an English professor from St. Olaf College, and this is a session called Who's On First? A discussion of baseball in American culture. Now, I know that it's Saturday night and everybody is itching to dance instead of sit and listen, so I'll promise that we'll be out of here by, well, within the hour and maybe 45 minutes. We call baseball the national pastime. And it's worth asking why baseball rather than some other sport? And why do we pay so much attention to it? And it's not just baseball. Why do we have such a national passion for sports in general and professional sports in particular? This month, one of the blessings of being at Holden is that we don't have to endure all the hype about the Super Bowl that the rest of the country is going through. One thing I was going to ask is that, I don't intend to do all the talking tonight, and I want to hear a lot of infield chatter, and not necessarily hissing, but that kind of infield talk. There are a lot of things that you and I could think of that indicate the ways in which our country pays special attention to baseball. You know, the president traditionally throws out the first pitch at the first baseball game of the year. In my family, it's a family tradition that we all go to the opening home game of the Twins. My parents and my family and my children, we all do it together. It always falls right near my dad's birthday, which is April 3rd. So it's sort of a huge celebration for our family. Whoever wins the World Series, the whole team is invited to the White House to meet the president, and you know, this adds that kind of national blessing to the whole thing. Thinking about our troops in other parts of the world after the Vespers today, do you remember what the nation gave as a gift to the American hostages who were held in Iran for 444 days back in 1979 and 80? Wasn't caps. Anybody remember what?
Videotapes of the series?
No?
Lifetime pass to any stadium in the
country. That's right. All the hostages, the greatest gift our nation could give to them was a lifetime pass to every baseball park in the country. Now think about that. A couple of years ago when I was doing a session on baseball here at Holden, one of the villagers who was from Iowa reported that a company in Iowa, this was at the time of Desert Storm, that a company in Iowa had sent countless electric lights, light standards, ballpark light standards to our troops in Desert Storm so they could play night baseball. It was too hot to play baseball in the daytime over there. But they wanted to play baseball so badly that they sent over light standards just so the troops could play ball when they weren't fighting. Probably somebody has done this to the troops in Somalia by now, for all I know. Anyway, there are lots of ways in which, as a country, we seem to do things that connect baseball with ourselves as a nation. And many of us do this as individuals. You know, if you promise you won't tell President George, I spend more time reading the box scores than reading poetry. Although I'm sure Mel George does too. You know, he too is a baseball fanatic. It's always fascinating to me why a whole city will just go bonkers when its team gets into the World Series or wins the World Series. Some of us were there in Minneapolis in 1987 and 91 when we won the World Series. Karen and I were dancing in the streets at midnight after the seventh game. And there's Mark with his Twins shirt on way up here at Holden. There's lots of evidence about this importance of baseball. I still remember my first trip to Holden in 1979. We drove across South Dakota from Minnesota, and we drove west of Pierre and took one of the back highways. We weren't on the freeway. One of the most desolate highways I've ever driven on. There's virtually nothing between Pierre, South Dakota, and Sturgis for about 150 miles. There's a little town about 40 miles west of Pierre. This is out in the country where they filmed Dances with Wolves and those buffalo scenes. Remember those scenes? Nothing, absolutely nothing out there. 5 miles beyond this little town, the road took a turn, and there at this intersection, huge light standards and a baseball diamond. And I learned that Karen's father used to play baseball there when he lived in Pierre. They'd drive 45 miles out in the country just to play ball there. And then, my first day here at Holden, I took my first hike up the road, and first thing I run into is a baseball diamond laid out there. We can't see it very well under the snow right now. But the first thing these miners did back in the 30s was find the only flat piece of ground within 30 miles, and they lay out a baseball diamond on it. And in the summertime, if you're up here, you can still see the rotting first base bleachers set into the hill along the first baseline of that baseball diamond. Always baseball. And this has fascinated me for a long time. I mean, I know I love this game for lots of reasons, and I know some of you don't. And I wonder about people like me who seem to have an undue interest in this. But I teach a course on baseball and American culture in college, because I think studying sport and the role in which, the way in which we take part in sport and our attitudes towards sport tells a lot about you and me as individuals, as well as a lot about us as a culture. And I'd be interested in hearing either your skeptical questions about why people pay attention to this, or your explanation about why sport is so important. I mean, I have some thoughts about that, and I'm sure you do as well. When I teach a course on baseball, we read a lot of baseball literature, and I'll show you some of the books that we read, because people always ask, what in the world do you read in such a course? And we talk about all sorts of things. We talk about the metaphysics of games. How are they put together? How do they work? What are the underlying philosophies of games and sports? We talk about aesthetics, the beauty, the gracefulness of sports. We talk about sociology. We talk about economics. We talk about language. Now, we may take some time tonight just thinking of the different phrases that we use constantly in our language that are taken straight from baseball. There are some from other sports as well, but not nearly as many as there are from baseball. I got to keep remembering Brad's up there. Truth squad. make sure I don't forget there are other sports as well. The history, it's remarkable the kind of things that has happened in our history because of baseball. I mean, one of the things that I often think of is the civil rights movement and the Jackie Robinson story. We all know about the fact that Jackie Robinson was the first modern day, that is 20th century, black player in the major leagues. Black people were excluded from the major leagues. And baseball has a lot to be ashamed about, and still does, about the role in which certain minorities play. But in 1947, Branch Rickey, in a very intentional, very careful plan, arranged to have Jackie Robinson brought into the major leagues. And this created a real stir when he played for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And on their first Southern road trip, they played the St. Louis Cardinals, which was the only team in the National League that was from a southern state, Missouri. And when the Brooklyn team came for the first time with a black player to play in St. Louis, the St. Louis Cardinal players announced that they were going to refuse to take the field against a team that had a black player. And the president of the National League, whose name was Ford Frick, later became commissioner of baseball, he announced to the St. Louis Cardinal players, if you don't take the field and play against Jackie Robinson and the Dodgers, none of you will ever play another Major League Baseball game the rest of your life. And he had the power to do that. Baseball has given these immense powers to the presidents of the leagues and to the commissioners. Some of that has deteriorated in the last few years. But long before we were able to do similar kinds of things in the civil rights movement as a nation, to do this politically, baseball, because of its importance to many people and because of the power of the commissioners, was able to do that. Let me tell you the books that we use in the course, just so that I'll just put these up here, and if any of you are interested in reading baseball, there's wonderful literature about baseball. These are some of the novels that I use in this course. And many of you have seen the movies of some of these. You've seen Robert Redford in The Natural. Shoeless Joe is a novel that Field of Dreams was based on. Mark Harris has written two novels called The Southpaw and Bang the Drum Slowly. I think these are the two best baseball books ever written, which is wonderful reading. Ring Lardner, who was a journalist back in the 20s, wrote this book called You Know Me, Al, which are the letters of a cocky, young, wild left-handed pitcher, a little bit like the pitcher in Bull Durham, which we saw on the bus on the way out here, who thinks he's much better than he actually is. He's dumb as can be, and all sorts of hilarious jokes are played on him. It's a hilarious book. Eric Rolf Greenberg has written a book that's usually out of print, but it's a wonderful book called The Celebrant, about what it means to be a fan. And what this book points out is that being a fan, for some people, is more than just liking a team. But to be a celebrant, in the sense that we use that in a religious way, in the sense that we celebrate the Mass, or we celebrate a religious holiday, you celebrate a hero. Sven talked about the need for heroes, and many of our heroes are sports figures, and some people are celebrants of their heroes, and this book explains that whole phenomenon very much. I had a hero in my youth, and Amy asked me if I was going to talk about the Cubs today. And I used to be a Cubs fan, and most Cubs fans stay Cubs fans. They're called the diehard Cubs fans because they just don't quit. And people keep wondering, why can't the Cubs win the pennant? And I know why. They traded my hero. They traded Andy Pafko on June 15th, 1951, just hours before the trading deadline. And since that day, Chicago has never won the pennant, gotten into the World Series. And don't know if they ever will make it. But this was a hero for me, and someone whom I've had the good fortune to tell you about it sometime. I wrote to him, and he invited me to come and talk with him. I spent 4 hours with him in the restaurant. And it was great fun to meet my hero and discover that he wasn't a drunken sot or anything like that, but he really was a good person. Philip Roth, who has written a lot about the Jewish experience in America, has written the only novel in our literature that's actually titled The Great American Novel. And of course,
about baseball. It's hilarious and it's outrageous and it's disgusting. And for English majors, it's wonderful because it's full of all sorts of in-jokes about literature. A lot of parodying of writers whom you'll recognize. There are a lot of other good novels that are written, so I can make this into a good literature book. But there's a lot of other non-fictional writing about baseball. Roger Angel covers baseball for the New Yorker. And he has the job that many of us academic-type baseball lovers would kill for. His job is to cover baseball for the New Yorker and write two or three articles a year. And they send him all over to go to baseball games everywhere, and he gets the best seats at the World Series and writes this big, long article. It's usually in November it shows up in the New Yorker. He's a marvelous writer and explains the whole season, and especially the World Series. Every 5 years, all of his articles are collected into a book, and they're wonderful books. The first one is called The Summer Deep. Thomas Boswell has written two books. He covers baseball for the Baltimore Sun. And the very titles of these books indicate, you know, very proper attitude toward baseball. How Life Imitates the World Series, the title of his first collection. The second one, Why Time Begins on Opening Day. A man named Daniel Okrent has written a book called Nine Innings, which is a 300-page book describing a single baseball game between the Baltimore Orioles and the Milwaukee Brewers, a meaningless game in the middle of the 1986 season, and takes 300 pages to describe it. But in that book, you learn so much about the things that most fans in the stands don't understand, like what's going through the mind of the batter as he's trying to figure out whether the next pitch is going to be a low outside curveball or a high inside slider or a fastball down the middle. What's he thinking in order to figure that out? You know, what is the shortstop doing out there? Is he kicking pedals around and figuring out where to stand? There's so much intense thinking going on in baseball, and this book reveals a lot of the behind-the-scenes things. And then if you're a lover of baseball, or you know someone who is, and you can't figure out what to give that person for Christmas or birthday, The Ultimate Baseball Book, big coffee table book filled with all sorts of historical pictures, as well as a kind of thumbnail sketch of the history of Major League Baseball. Well, do any of you have a sense of, or an idea of why it is that baseball is the sport that we have picked out as the national pastime or our American game? Some of you, I am sure, are baseball fans.
Because anyone can play it.
That's right. I think that's one reason. I can visualize myself getting a hit in a major league game or picking up a grounder and throwing a batter out, but I cannot imagine myself being a halfback and carrying a football past six people like Brad, you know, and coming out alive, right? And it is a game where you don't have to be 7 feet tall or 260 pounds. Some players are, but there are a lot of, there's a greater variety of body types who can succeed in baseball than a lot of other sports. But anybody can play it. That's one good answer. Yeah.
I think it's all about summer and enjoying summer.
Mm-hmm. One reason some people seem to respond to it is it's part of the annual cycle of the seasons, isn't it? Life does begin on opening day. This is what I call the dark half of the year. Not because the days are shorter, but because there's no baseball. But it is the dark half as well. And somehow springtime, you know, can start imagining the crack of the bat on the ball down there in Florida when the spring training is starting, and things just feel a little bit better. When opening day comes around, spring is here for some of us. And when the World Series is over, you know, 3 days after the World Series a year ago, we get the big blizzard of the big Halloween blizzard, and summer's over. The timing is really interesting in that regard. And it is called the Summer Game, as one of these books is titled. It's a thing that a lot of people do in the summer. Any other? And one of the things about the game is you focus on individuals, is that the players are alone. You know, it's a team sport, but the players are not huddled together. Most of the time they are all out alone, where whatever they do well or badly, is obvious to anyone who's paying attention. America is built on the concept of individualism, you know, that each of us is an individual, and we try to allow our individuality to be developed, and we rise or fall on the basis of our personal merit. And there's not much in sport that is as much an individual thing as that batter standing in the batting box facing Roger Clemens, you know, and trying to swing the bat and hit the ball. I mean, that's really a one-on-one individual thing. And then if the ball gets hit hard and far, it's all up to that outfielder who can run fast enough and leap, but time things just right to make the catch or miss it, drop it. No help from the teammates, you know, in a lot of what happens in baseball. And a lot of team sports are different. What happened to my eraser here? Speaking about the concept of the game and what happened, how do most games played with a ball work? What's the goal?
Put the ball someplace.
Okay, you put the ball someplace. And where is that place?
Goals, boots, end zones.
Okay.
The
other team's territory. And what do you do to try to prevent that from happening?
Defend your territory.
You defend your territory. You get your body between, you know, if we're looking on the side view here, and we've got goalposts here, and here's a football field, here's a 50-yard line. One team is defending all this territory, and especially the end zone, and the other team is defending this. And the whole object is to get that ball into the other team's territory, right? It's a territorial game. And everybody, you defend your territory by getting between that ball and your home and try to keep it from getting there. You do the same thing in soccer, in hockey. A lot of games that are played that way. Now, when you realize that this is a territorial game, and since you have to use your bodies to keep that missile from getting into your territory, violence is almost sure to happen, right? You are crashing into each other, there's pushing, shoving, kicking, this ball, you know, going, and there's a lot of danger out there, and it's like a battleground in a certain way. The way we defend our borders when there's a war. When basketball was invented, James Naismith wanted to think of a ball game where it would be impossible to have this belligerent body contact protection of the... Yeah, it's funny to think about now. And what he did, you see, if we're always trying to push a ball across this imaginary vertical plane that is the goal line and everything above it, the job is to push the ball with a puck, soccer ball, through that imaginary plane. He reasoned in order to avoid all this people bumping into each other out here in front of that area, as the ball tries to get there, he's just going to take that plane and put it 10 feet in the air and tip it horizontally, and then require that the ball have to come down here. And then nobody can get in there. Nobody can get in the way and block that ball from getting there. So there won't be any body contact. And nobody gets hurt. It's fun to imagine, but if he were alive today and watched basketball, you know, how amazed he'd be. But the theory, you see, was to avoid this punch-it-through kind of philosophy. And worked for a while as people just dribbled along, took long set shots, and that was the strategy, and nobody got hurt. But things changed. Now, how does baseball work? What's the spatial principle of baseball?
It can be hit almost anywhere within an angle.
Anything
can score.
And we've got this right angle here.
And you could.
How do you score? You don't score by getting into the opponent's territory, do you? How do you score?
You have to leave home and get back home.
You have to come home.
Yeah.
Instead of leave home and go to somebody's, the enemy's place, you take a little trip and come home. And this is how you score. You go around here and you get back here to the home plate.
Just make a little trip through enemy territory.
Yeah, you do. You do. But you don't try to, you don't bump into the enemy to knock them out of the way. I mean, there's a little of this at home plate, but there's this huge space out here, and all you want to do is to get back home again, and if you do that more times than they do, well, you win. Totally different concept than getting into the enemy territories as many times. What else about just the concept of the game is different from some of the others?
Well, you don't take the ball with you. You want to get rid of it while you go do that. You want to
take
it away.
Yeah, you don't take it with you. You get it far away from yourself. In fact, what's the one thing that the offensive team cannot do with the ball? You can't touch it. If you're on the offense, when you're at bat, you can't touch the ball. In all these other games, most of them anyway, you're touching the ball all the time as you bring it into the enemy territory. In baseball, you don't touch it at all. And it's one of the rare games where that's the case. In fact, you're out. If you're a runner out here and the ball touches you, you're out and you lose ground instead of gaining. So you try to knock that ball someplace else where the other team can't get it, giving you time to take your own trip and come home. Anything else?
You don't have to hit the ball to score. You get free passes or you can steal it away around.
That's right. If the other team is careless or shoddy, if the pitcher isn't good, you can be rewarded and they can be discredited by getting around there pretty easily. It puts a real premium on that talent. But the same thing might be said of some other sports too. If one team is really good and the other team is bad, why disaster happens. But it is a game where you don't have to do very much except exercise good judgment and let the pitcher walk you and you can score.
And you're allowed to steal things.
Right, you're allowed to steal. Interesting word that we use there. Is there theft and deception involved here? One of the things that is interesting about baseball is that almost all of its rules are intended to disallow deception. Yet we still talk about stealing. The infield fly rule, for instance, is specifically designed to
keep an infielder from deceiving a runner and therefore accomplishing a double play that can't be done otherwise. A balk, the balk rule, is designed to keep the pitcher from deceiving the runner and the batter about when the ball can be thrown. So baseball tries to create rules that don't allow deception. You aren't allowed to put a foreign substance on the ball when you're pitching it, supposedly. And we have all these umpires out there as kind of the policemen to make sure that the rules are followed. But every sport has got some of those. But there is, it's interesting that we call it stealing second or third base. Actually, you're just being more skilled. You're timing the point you leave first base, and run there, and you get there faster than the catcher has the skill to throw you out. But, you know, it's really a skill thing. It's not really theft, in my judgment. It's well earned. If you steal a base, it's well earned, isn't it? What else?
How would you compare that stealing to the stealing basketball?
Well, the same thing. That if you've got the quickness and the skill to anticipate, move, and leap in between two players and intercept the ball, that's not illegal theft. You know, the word theft suggests breaking the law. I think that that's just good skill. Well, and one of the other things, almost every field, every playing field in almost every sport has predetermined dimensions, right? And it's not true of every baseball field. Things are standard down here in the kind of urban area where there's a lot of activity and a lot of people. But out here in the countryside, in the rural parts, all sorts of weird things, you know, happen to the outfield wall, the height, the dimensions, so that the conditions aren't the same on every park that you play in, and that makes the game much more interesting. And then we've got these individuals out in the pasture, watching over their territory, you know, trying to see to it that bad things don't happen out there. And everybody's got a role out there. And most of the things that happen, most of the teamwork that happens in baseball happens consecutively. I mean, this player picks up a ball, throws it to the shortstop who would come out to be the cutoff man, who then throws it down to the catcher who tries to tag out the runner, trying to score from second. This player does something, and then this player does something, and then this player, rather than all doing it together as happens in some sports. Well, I don't know if some of these things make the game more American than, say, football or basketball or soccer, but it does make this game different from a lot of other sports. The playing field varies. The players are really out there exposed as individuals, and everything they do well or badly is noticed by everyone, whereas when an interior lineman makes a mistake, you know, before instant replay anyway, we couldn't always tell, you know, why a play worked or failed.
So they throw a big yellow flag and announce his name, number 76.
Right. But most of us don't see that anyway, because we're watching the ball carrier or something. But in baseball, it's pretty hard to not see an error. So there's a great deal of pressure on the individual player. Well, think about some of those things as you think about why this game is different. Some people do consider it American because it has this sense of the rural as well as the urban down here. That it's a game of going out into the territories and coming home. And it's not designed to be a penetration of enemy territory, but rather a different sort of thing that appeals to a lot of people. most of us never even think about these things when we think about the game. Another factor about baseball that I think is truer than in most sports, virtually everything that happens is counted. Every pitch, every play, the statistics are maintained for every single thing. Every time a player touches the ball or misses a ball, it counts. And all the good things are counted, all the negative things are counted. We've got all these statistics. You know, we've got all these baseball cards, you know, with all the statistics on the back. And we love to pore over these things and memorize them. When I was a kid, I knew the batting average of every player in the major leagues on any given day. My mind can't handle that anymore, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff like that that a lot of us remember. That's a little bit about the metaphysics of sport. It's interesting to think about the principles behind sports, and most of the time we don't pay any attention to that, but it's fun to think about. One of the things that I'd like to have you help me think about is the way in which sport, and this one in particular, is part of our religious impulse. One of the books that I love to read and I've used as a textbook sometimes is a book called The Joy of Sports by Michael Novak. Michael Novak is a famous American theologian and economist, and he's a sports fanatic, and he wrote a book called The Joy of Sports, in which he discusses football and basketball as well as baseball. And part of what fascinates him is the religious impulses in human beings that are embodied in sports. Now, if you think for a few minutes, I think we can fill this board with ways in which our participation in sports or our viewing of sports bear a frightening resemblance to our participation in worship. Anybody got a thought right off the bat? I can start recording.
Singing.
Okay, that's singing.
Eating.
Eating. Okay. Okay, we have a congregation.
For football, they go every Sunday to a temple.
All right. You got the sometimes we think of it as the holy places.
The Jewish, yeah.
I was thinking you live a myth, too, or baseball players do. Like, Scott, when you said that you do go into enemy territory, it reminded me of stuff I learned from reading Joseph Campbell about the hero's journey, that you can do it by the book and just sort of be a staid player and make your way around the bases and, you know, be a safe player. That can be different for your life. And, you know, you can be nondescript and you'll do okay. Or you can be this crafty, sneaky person who, you know, gets around in other ways and embodies some kind of myth. And I think we do that in our...
Okay.
By participation in ritual in both places, I think we are part of...
And we have our... What does baseball do with its large, mythic people?
Enshrine them.
We enshrine the heroes. 2 days ago, Reggie Jackson was elected to the Hall of Fame. Every year, we immortalize two or three players. This year, only one made it, Reggie Jackson. Now, have any of you been to Cooperstown? Was it impressive?
I was 6. Yes.
Well, I was 46, and it was impressive. Yeah, I didn't think I would be so taken by this columned place where these bronze plaques are there of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Willie Mays and a whole bunch. It's really quite moving to some of us. But we've got our place of enshrinement, the Holy of Holies.
The other part of that is I think we want to be part of something bigger. And that if I'm a Twins fan, then I'm one of many. If I'm a Lutheran, I'm one of many. And I know
okay.
what a lot of those people believe.
So there's a kind of, what we call this, group identity. One of the things that's fun to think about is the way in which we align ourselves with a team. Some people who grew up in Brooklyn, you know, have always been Dodger fans. Even after the Brooklyn Dodgers moved to Los Angeles, they continue to be Dodger fans, even though they're 3,000 miles away and we'll never see them play again in person. Other Brooklyn people quickly adopted the Mets, which was the next team to come to town. And simply are fans of the team closest at hand. I used to be a Cubs fan until they traded Andy Pafko. And then I moved to Madison, Wisconsin, and lo and behold, Andy Pafko is playing for the Milwaukee Braves. So I had double reason for becoming a Braves fan. And then I moved to Minneapolis and to Northfield, and I'm a Twins fan. I've changed my loyalties and always root for the locals.
Don't move to Seattle.
Believe me, again, when I thought about job changes, the first thing I think about is the nearest Major League Baseball team. Or is there one? But think about, you know, why you or somebody else has stayed with a team at hand or changed loyalties when you move or don't change loyalties when you move. And what's going on here in this identification with this team, these players? You know, these players becoming more and more evident, they're just a bunch of hired mercenaries, right? You know, they sell themselves to the highest bidder, very little loyalty to the local place, and they'll go off and play for whoever will pay the most. And how can we show such loyalty to those kinds of people? But we do if they're playing for us.
Well, Kirby Puckett wanted this day in the interview.
Yes, he did. Bless his soul. Yeah. Kirby's different from all the rest.
He's settled down.
Yeah.
Although this wasn't true in your case, most of us have a sense of forgiveness for our favorite team. You know, next year they'll do it, or next week they're going to win, and if our favorite player happens to have a night off or whatever, we forgive them, and all the things will turn around next time.
Why is attendance so high during the years that the Twins win the pennant? It's not just the Twins. And then when they come in last, where are all those people? I'm there at the ballpark, but you know, there are millions who aren't there. But they, yeah, that's right. Okay, there's another good example. You know. Some people show up only on the festive events. Show up at Christmas or World Series. Yeah.
On the way home from church every Sunday, I know my dad listens to Sid Hartman's preaching.
Okay. We got our preachers too, don't we? Okay, think more about worship now. What else? Similar.
Well, there's a lot of ritual in football.
Okay, lots of ritual.
A lot of little phobias that the players have, and the fans too, like they'll wear a certain cap or a certain sweater or something for months.
Won't change their underwear when you're in a winning streak and things like that.
A basketball coach who wore the same jacket for an entire season because they kept on winning.
Yeah.
They have the communion, the stands, to get the popcorn, okay. Yeah.
Okay,
whatever.
That I think was what was getting at here with the
oh,
eating
I
and drinking.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's a kind of ritual eating. Maybe peanuts is the closest thing to the wafer that we have. But what other kind of rituals do you see in baseball? That
seventh inning stretch.
Okay, seventh inning stretch. About time for that. What? The wave? Okay, the wave.
Oh,
disgusting.
I don't attribute that to any sport.
Nah.
No, that's
fan inexperience and boredom.
That's right. People who aren't paying attention.
The wave does not belong in sport.
Erase that.
Come on.
Really? What other rituals?
Arguing with umpires.
Arguing with umpires.
Okay. That there's never an immediate outcome, but you know you're arguing for next time.
Okay.
The players taking the field at the beginning and all running out.
Okay, the
sending
singing of the national anthem.
First two.
Okay. Let's see. Taking the field is sort of like a processional, you know, everyone goes out there together. We've got the national anthem.
The umpire always says play ball.
Okay.
Spitting and scratching.
The gender check is fine.
Think more about church.
You give an offering of money.
Okay, there's payment, that's right.
Pressures come on.
Okay, we got the pews, we got the dugout, which is sort of like the choir loft or something like that. You know, the special place where certain participants stay.
I think now that a lot of teams are thinking about moving, you know, they move a lot, that a lot of times there's even guilt when people don't go to the games.
Okay. We've got guilt. We've even got penance, right? Okay, what connection?
The pulpit.
Okay.
You get a new preacher with tensions and gears.
Okay. Yeah, the manager is sort of like the pastor of.
What's that organ?
Very good. The organ music. Programs.
Most key positions are held by men.
Right.
The clergy, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, bat boys and altar boys.
Okay, good.
We have that from the
previous. Yeah, the Candlestick Park. Candlestick Park, right. Yeah, you're on a roll here. What?
Vestments and uniforms.
Okay, we've got the vestments, the uniforms.
Players that talk crap and TV evangelist.
We got the evangelist. Absurdities, yeah.
Artifacts.
Got artifacts. The relics.
Holy relics.
Okay. Anybody here have a baseball relic at home?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. And people, look what we do just to get a baseball that's been hit, a foul ball hit into the stands. You know, people just about kill themselves to just come home with that. This was fouled off by Kent Herbeck. You know,
holy
therefore, grace. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the World Series trophy, isn't it? That is the Holy Grail everyone's going after. Great.
Depending on which team you like prayer.
Okay. Okay. The fans are literally praying sometimes, and you see some players crossing themselves at various points.
A celebration.
Yeah. This is a little spooky, isn't it? I mean, that so much of what is part of our worship, in which we worship those things that are ultimately significant in human existence, we do all this with sport. And, well, we could go on perhaps and do more, but that's quite a
quite a list of stuff that suggests to me, maybe to you, that our attention to sport, and this one in particular, is almost like a kind of civic religion. You know, it's we behave toward it. Some people behave toward it much more reverentially than they do to anything having to do with church. And others will pop right from doing all of this in church and drive right out to the ballpark and do it all over again at a football stadium or a baseball park, and care probably more about the sport, a lot of people, than about what happened in church. What does this suggest about us? Does this make us irreverent or flippant? Or is this mere coincidence? Does this tell us anything important about ourselves?
We like form.
Pardon?
I'm sorry, we like form.
We like form, yeah.
But comfortability.
Yeah.
It's a very concrete activity. You watch every play that goes on, and as you said, there are so many statistics. Everything is recorded accurately and in detail, volume after volume.
Yeah.
There's no question as to what transpired.
That's right.
It's very real.
There's a sort of certitude.
Nothing that's up there that you can identify.
Yeah.
Everything that happens. At any moment, you go look it up 10 years from now, and it's as accurate then as it is now. There's no interpretation.
Okay.
There's no confusion about what transpires.
Is this a thing that makes it differ from, say, religious faith, where perhaps there isn't as much certitude, or at least evidence, and here's something about which there's abundant evidence and certitude?
Well, I think it's easy for people to identify with it. They can touch it. It's tangible.
Yeah.
Every event is there. They don't have to rely upon history from 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. It's right now. We can see it.
Mm-hmm. Granted, a lot of people, of course, claim that they were present at a great many events.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, one
that's
of the
right.
The lines was the night Henry Aaron hit 715, and the announcer said, as I was watching the ball game, he said, 10 years from now, 150 million people claim they saw this play.
Yeah.
When actually only about 25 million were watching on TV.
Now you see how the number 715 just rolled off his lips. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain numbers that all of us know. 2,130. 61, 755 now. Things that baseball fans, you know exactly, you know, what record is being referred to. 400. Yeah.
I would like to return to your topic of church just a moment.
Okay.
After what Mark was saying, to think that, you know, if there's some parallels to be drawn in a wider sense, things. And some of the conversation here, if your establishment in here and to baseball, you know, there are obviously, you know, parallels to be reached in looking at a range of types of churches. I mean, you can talk about, you know, ritual and that sort of thing, but you can also talk about types of churches. And
mm-hmm.
It seems that, you know, this kind of fervent, you know, or reverence to the game is a lot like fundamentalism. And it, you know, which can be really popular for a number of reasons that people are looking for such a security and things. There's a lot of security in what Jeff is saying, patterns, and we're looking for form and some sort of structure and regularity and playing out between good and evil and these sorts of things. And I think
that's
pretty clear.
That's a good point. I mean, there's a lot of being sure, being dogmatic about who's better, who's going to win, which player is better than another, and so forth, and that perhaps does sound a lot like certain fundamental approaches. Well, look,
sometimes I wonder, it just entered my mind that possibly it's one of the last bastions of the boys' club, to the baseball.
Of the
men's club, because women can participate in the game as spectators, and they can make an attempt to play it, but they really haven't yet cracked the barrier, and I can see it happening in the next 10 to 20 years. There are a few women who made gallant efforts and have been squashed or didn't have the physical skills necessary to you know, command the respect of the play. So men are able to control this game. It is just so rule-laden, and a great many men love rules. There's no question. The rules are all written down. You can't deviate from the rules.
Yeah,
it's just like, this is the way the game is, damn it. If you don't like it, go home. And a lot of men like that. They thrive on that. They need that for their very existence. And they also need to feel, in some sense, a bond with other men.
Yeah.
This is a very classic way to bond with other men. And they don't mind if women want to watch. But there's still, I think, are a lot of men who say, you can watch all you want, women, but you're not really ever going to be the part of the club.
Maybe the demise of baseball will come when women finally have equal opportunity and equal power in our culture. You know, that maybe at that point, baseball.
What? No more spitting? No more scratching?
But don't you think they probably said almost the same thing when blacks started going into baseball? This is the end. Now the blacks are coming in. I mean,
there was a lot of heads.
Yeah, I'm sure there was.
And I would think that women it would be much easier for women to play baseball than football or basketball. And why haven't women come into that team yet?
And some of you may have seen the movie A League of Their Own. There actually was a women's professional baseball league.
Yeah, but again, that's separate. There were black baseball teams, too.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know the answer to that. It's interesting to speculate about it. One of the things that's been true of my baseball courses is that, except for one time, every time I've taught it, the most knowledgeable baseball person in the course was a woman. There are a lot of women baseball fans, but they haven't had the opportunity to grow up playing it on the level that men have had the chance to do it. And my wife always reminds me the reason this is a national game is because it's a men's game, and this is still a men's country, and there's maybe a lot of truth to that. Well, I promised it wouldn't go any longer than this. A lot of other things we could talk about, and I thank you for, helping me think through this business about religion and sport. I do happen to believe that sport, that human beings are creatures that play. We aren't just creatures who work, but we're creatures who play. And that part of our interest in sport is a living out of this human instinct that many of us, especially in the academic world, don't want to give any credit to, because we want to think of ourselves as creatures who think. But this is another way of acknowledging the body and what we do with it.
It's kind of like hiring somebody else to play for you, or somebody else to intercede for you in the church. Are they playing work and just watch somebody else and kind of remove us from an active playing?
That's true. That's what some of us do by just being spectators instead of participants. And others will do both.